This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
This is the second event of this kind that the Economic Research Council has staged, where we've managed to turn economics and forecasting into a competitive sport. I think we'll soon see it on Saturday night as weekly entertainment. There's a lot of argument about what exactly is the nature of economics. Is economics a science? Is it a social science? Is it a branch of natural sciences? Is it mathematical? Or is it history? Or is it a social science? I've even heard one former Chancellor Exchequer say it was a branch of foreign policy. And I've heard businessmen say that it's just warfare carried on by other means. I myself have to confess that although I think this is a wonderful event, that I've always been deeply sceptical about economic forecasting. I've always had sympathy with the view of Dennis Healy that forecasters, economic forecasters, exist in order to give weather forecasters a good name. In fact, Dennis Healy announced his ambition to do for economic forecasters what the Boston Strangler did for door-to-door salesmen. I always remember the day when I first became Chancellor of Exchequer and I walked into the Treasury and Sir Terence Burns said, Chancellor, which pointed at the tip of my shoulder, and he said, you do realise you will soon be the most unpopular man in the country. And I always say, during the entire time I was at the Treasury, that was the only forecast that was correct. That's not actually quite true, because there was one other forecast that proved correct. That was my notorious remark for the older members in the audience who remember this about the green shoots of economic recovery. Of course, now it appears absolutely accurate. What use was it? Because at the time, absolutely nobody believed it, even though today the statistics would indicate it was, dare I say, remarkably prescient. Dostoevsky, the Russian novelist, once said, and I think this is my starting point about economic forecasting, that of all human folly, prophecy was the most gratuitous. Or as a Russian once said to me, economic forecasting is like looking for a black cat in a room with the lights out and the cat isn't there. Or as my Japanese colleague used to say, 6 inches ahead, all is darkness. There was a once upon a time famous conservative politician called Edmund Dukan, and he, I thought, summed it up very well. He said, if you must, forecast the past, if pushed, the present, but never ever the future. And actually, if you think about it, that is what most pundits on television do. It's what most people who comment in Sunday newspapers do. You take what's happened in the last 6 months of the 6 years, they extrapolate it. If they're feeling a bit gloomy, they say the next year up 10%, down 10%. If they're feeling a little bit optimistic, they say up 10%. And most people just extrapolate from where we are now. But that isn't really a very good way of forecasting a turning point or an inflection point. But I used to think it was the ultimate in wisdom until I attended, I'm not sure it wasn't in this building, a lecture given by a fellow of the Royal Statistical Society, and he delivered himself of this observation. He said, the past uncertainty, although on the whole it's not as great as that of the future. And I only realized the truth of that when I wrote a book about my own time at the Treasury, and when I was looking at the files and then looking at the reports of the Treasury at that time, I realized that all the statistics that I had been presented with as Chancellor of the Exchequer had changed dramatically. I had thought I had presided over the deepest recession since the 1930s slump. It turned out to be one of the shallowest recessions since the Second World War. That was how the revisions portrayed it. I remember how Harold Wilson lost a general election on the back of a current account deficit, which was largely caused allegedly by the import of some jumbo jets from the United States. 5 years later, the current account deficit was entirely revised out of existence. So please bear that in mind, because at a certain point this evening, I'm going to declare the winner of our economic forecasting competition. And of course, he may be the winner now, but how will he look in 5 years' time? It may be that the person who's second, or even the person who's third, may actually come out and be the eventual winner. I mean, if only we could stick to the Chinese system where the statistics are never revised, life would be so much more certain. So I retain a great skepticism, although I'm delighted to chair this event, delighted that the ERC does it. But I think we ought to remember the maxim, if we're really making this into a sporting contest, we ought to remember the maxim: it matters not whether you win or lost, but how you played the game. And I think the really interesting part about the competition is not who is accurate, but what were the reasons they gave. The reasons are more interesting, and whether they were right or wrong. And so let's pay special attention tonight to the reasons people give, the analysis they give for their forecasts. Now, having said all that, here I am standing next to a cup like the late Queen Mother at Ascot, about to give it to the winner of our competition. I ought to announce that our winner was Professor Mulbar from Oxford, who is the winner with 35 points. Professor Pecheran of Cambridge was second with 50 points. You would immediately perceive that the people with the fewest points wins. I'm not quite sure how these points have been calculated, because I was saying you look at the quarterly forecast for inflation, the quarterly forecast for GDP, the quarterly forecast for unemployment. Of course, if you put the four together and took a through-year figure as opposed to a quarterly-by-quarterly figure, you might get an entirely different result. But I'm told by the criteria that the judges used until the third quarter of this year, when our winner took the lead in the third year, in third place was the LSE's Danny Kwa, in second place was Hashim Pecheran, who's so annoyed about losing that he's immigrated to the University of California. And the winner, as I say, is Professor Mulbar. So please come and accept your applause. We also ran an audience competition to win a case of wine, which was even closer than the main competition. Honourable mention has to go to Tim Congdon, Siva Sabatranam, who came third and second respectively. But the overall winner was Peter Henderson, who I understand is not here tonight, but please give him a round of applause. If you would like to win a prize this year, you'll find an entry form in the packs which you were handed on in the way in. Please give those back to us tonight at the end of the evening, and we will be able to judge your entry. Moving on to this evening, we have three new professors, again from Oxford, Cambridge and the LSE, Professor Linda Yue from Cambridge, Michael Kitson from the LSE, Professor Itan Jozepski. I'm going to ask Linda to speak first. She is a fellow from St. Edmunds Hall, Oxford, an adjunct professor of economics at the London Business School. She is economics show on Bloomberg TV, which many people will have seen. She's advised the World Bank, the European Commission, the Asian Development Bank, and the World Economic Forum. She will speak for 15 minutes, 5 minutes summarizing what's happened in the last year, 5 minutes on three things she would do if she were in power now. And she's going to say this on the eve, of course, of the autumn statement. And she's going to give 5 minutes to her predictions. So, Linda, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Lord Lamont. And just to be clear, the Titans referred to in this title is Oxford, clearly not me. And what I'm going to do is, as Lord Lamont says, it's just a look at this year. And then I really struggled with the second section about if I were in power, what would I do? I just couldn't actually possibly imagine being in power at this point of this economy. And then 3 points about to look for in the future. And then I'll go through some of my forecasts. I loved the anecdotes that Lord Lamont has already given, but it reminded me of one, which is one of my favorites from John Kenneth Galbraith. And he had said that forecasters exist to make astronomers look respectable. So now that you have utter confidence in what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to first start off just with a few things which are notable in 2012. I've picked really three things in each of the topics that I was charged to speak on, just really in the interest of time. I think this list probably could have been a lot longer, because for economists, this has actually been a very fascinating time in terms of rethinking how we view the economy. So these are the three things that I've pointed to in terms of their impact on the British economy. And I've intentionally made these. I don't want to use the word sensational, but I've tried to be a little bit more provocative with some of these thoughts. So I hope to have a good conversation with you afterwards, if time permits. One is that I think what was notable is that this year, the acute phase of the euro crisis, and I've put over in parentheticals, because I think this is one of the biggest worries on our doorstep. And the reason why I describe it this way is I actually have looked at the euro crisis quite a bit. I sometimes feel like it's one of the only things that people talk about if you ever go to a conference on the continent. But to me, one of the key signs about it moving beyond the crisis phase into the hard structural work the eurozone needs to do is a very simple test, in a sense. If a eurozone country asks for a rescue, and markets and economists and commentators and analysts don't ask the question, will the euro survive? To me, that would be a turning point, because that would make a rescue of a euro country much more like a rescue of any country. The IMF could step in and to help. Is the acute phase completely over? I'm going to say largely over, and that's what I have that in parentheticals, and that's why market tensions have come down a great deal, actually, just in the last few weeks. The second point is that emerging markets, again, decoupled from the West, and again, I use the term decoupled quite loosely, because it's not that emerging markets like China, like India, are not affected by the recession that Europe has found itself in again, but rather they have managed to not themselves fall into the kind of recession we saw 4 years ago. So, for instance, some of the worst affected countries in the 2008 crisis were not developed countries, even though the crisis stemmed from the United States. They were developing countries, and the IMF rescued scores and dozens of those countries. So, for me, this downturn showed that emerging economies suffered, but they didn't have the rescues that we saw so often just a few years ago. And then the third point that I put out here is that the UK has finally double-dipped into recession. The UK has had alternating negative and positive quarters. since the end of 2010. It's what Mervyn Keane describes as a zigzag pattern. It was only a matter of time before you ended up with two consecutive quarters of negative GDP, therefore constituting what economists call a technical recession. However, if you look at the alternating pattern, the UK has been recessionary for the last couple of years. And to me, this is one of the signs as to why it is. It's very difficult to be in power now because recovery from a banking crisis, that's a typical pattern. And quite a lot of research suggests that this kind of zigzag growth or quite stagnant growth is indeed what you would expect because the aftermath of a banking crisis tends to involve a credit squeeze, deleveraging debt repayment, and looking across the world, countries that recover from financial crises do take a long time to get back to pre-crisis levels of income. Rogoff and Reinhardt, in a very well-known book, Eight Centuries of Financial Folly, which is a great title, estimates it takes about 7 years for an economy to recover to pre-crisis levels of income, and we're not quite there yet. So, if I were in power, as I say, it's hard for me to imagine, but I put a few points on here, and I'm not expecting to see this tomorrow, by the way, in the autumn statement. I'm not that confident. I really think these are some of the issues about an economy after a financial crisis that needs to be thought about and addressed, if possible. So one of the very first things, as I say, is that if you're coming out from a crisis where there was a lot of leverage or debt in the system, then it's very difficult to rely on consumption as a driver of growth. And obviously, domestic demand comprises consumption, investment, and government spending. And then there's net exports to give you demand from overseas. So one of the ways in which countries look to recover by not relying on consumption is to boost investment. And some of the slashes in public investment that this government has undertaken is now being rolled back, according to announcement today. And I do think that is an area where it's more likely it's to get some driver there than, for instance, relying on consumption. And I put including in people because one of the most worrying effects of a prolonged recessionary time is that you end up with what's called hysteresis. So that's a medium-term effect where people who are unemployed find it difficult to go back into work. And that has the potential of keeping the economy below its potential, driving down its trend or normal growth rate. And as the economy today is still over 3% below pre-crisis levels, so that means 3% below plus losing the 2.75% growth rate that the economy should have been growing at over the past few years is one of the reasons why unemployment is so high and why it is that youth unemployment is so high. As the economy grows below the potential, it's very difficult to see how that can't be a policy area of priority. To me, that has to be one of the key priority areas. The second issue here is easing credit conditions further. And I've put on there, including for trade and investment. I don't know if many people realize this, but quite a lot of trade depends on trade finance. And because of the rolling back of not just British banks, but European banks, this has really been one of the biggest effects of the credit strain, which is on small businesses that would normally have would look to overseas markets if the domestic market is slow. So I think there have been positive steps in this front, funding for lending, but I think more needs to be done to make sure that credit is not a constraint so that firms that can export and rely on trade finance are not held back by what everybody, I think, recognizes, which is a real squeeze because of the state of the banks, whether the banks have to rebuild their balance sheets, funding costs are elevated partially because of the euro crisis, and there's lots of reasons why I think leveraging the government's record low borrowing costs to ease credit further, to me, has to be a priority. And for those who say it's a question of lack of demand, well, I say remove the supply side credit constraint, so you only have the depressed demand rather than having both. And I think that's got to be an issue as well. And then finally, I think this needs to happen, but I'm not very confident as to how this would happen. Policy uncertainty has to be reduced. It's almost, it's a very easy thing to say. It's a very hard thing to do. But one of the extraordinary facts about not just in Britain, but particularly in the United States and other parts of Europe, is that despite the fact that there is this credit squeeze, there are record amounts of cash holdings on U.S. corporate balance sheets. And corporates in Britain and corporates in Europe also have cash on their balance sheets. This happened in Japan as well. So the question is, why are they not investing? Why are they not spending? And uncertainty, policy uncertainty, does have a role to play in that. It's a very good research done by Nick Bloom, a colleague at the LSE, Center for Economic Performance, where I'm also an associate of, has looked at this and estimates policy uncertainty. They've begun to try and measure it, but the extent to which you can have certainty over the key things that help a corporation feel at either tax rates or regulations or expectations about the future are set as far in advance as possible, it helps them commit that investment. And that's how you would start a more virtuous circle. Okay, so my last few minutes looking into 2013. I've picked a few things here, and then I'll go into some of the forecasts. Like I said, there's lots of things I thought would be interesting here into the next year, but these are the three that I sort of settled on because I found them to be intellectually interesting. One is the Bank of England pioneers macroprudential policy. And I'm going to sound a little wonkish for a moment, so just bear with me, which is inflation targeting, which has been the dominant monetary policy in the West for the past 20 years, is about to get a facelift. It's become clear that a country cannot simply target price stability. You have to target financial stability. So it's not just about CPI or inflation, but the amount of liquidity or money in the system. Because clearly, in this last crisis, inflation around the world was extremely low, but credit was building up. Therefore, there is a dichotomy between the two. And the Bank of England is going to have a dual mandate where a financial policy committee will operate alongside the MPC, and they'll each target slightly different goals to make sure there isn't a divergence between what's happening on the inflation front and what's happening in terms of stability, overall financial stability. So that's my enthusiastic cheerleading push for how this is going to be a great new regime. And perhaps when we have time in the discussion, I can point out all the difficulties and challenges here, including, I'm not sure how one would define financial stability. I had a very bad feeling once looking into this that one of the temptations of defining it might be something like how a U.S. Supreme Court justice once described pornography. I'll know it when I see it, which I always thought would be not quite workable for financial stability. But anyways, this is the regime, I think, which will define the next era of monetary policy, and the Bank of England is at the forefront. It's also being done in the continent and elsewhere. Secondly, the UK escapes triple-dip recession, and this is because most of the economists and analysts, at least the ones that I'm going to show you, think that the UK, unfortunately, is going to have a negative quarter in this quarter, the fourth quarter of this year. However, if you look at what's happening in terms of policies to support lending and just slightly more positive signs in terms of especially private employment growth, I think the UK probably will end up escaping a triple-dip recession. But that's not to say it won't be stagnant or have a zigzag pattern. But this is my way of saying, I think, in many ways, and I'm going to borrow Lord Lamont's phrase, green shoots, possibly, but don't quote me, because I'm going to give you a forecast in a moment, and I'll tell you where they're from. And then finally, the world enters a new phase of multipolar growth. This is one of my favorite themes, which is, I think very quietly, emerging markets have actually driven more growth than the West. And I say quietly because we notice emerging markets in all sorts of ways. But if you look at breaking down what actually drives global growth, China is as important as the U.S. And in the coming years, China and India will be more important or as important as the United States. So therefore, multipolar world to me is a much more stable growth dynamic than if the world were to rely on a single engine like the United States. Now, when I say this in the U.S., I'm terribly unpopular, but I do think it is true. So I think the world will enter that phase, and there'll be challenges, but I think ultimately the emergence of a couple billion people beginning to join the middle class is a very positive sign for the rest of the world, including the U.K. So, predictions. We should really cross that out. It's not really from Oxford. Lord Lamont mentioned I have a role with Bloomberg. That means that I have access to their data, and they have a lot of data. It normally costs a fortune to access it. So what I've done is I've pulled consensus forecasts from Bloomberg. This is a consensus forecast from economists and analysts in the city and elsewhere. And this is where they see the UK economy contracting, as I say, slightly in the fourth quarter of this year, and then a gradual acceleration through next year. But there's a big caveat here that I have to make, which is this does not account for the royal baby effect. So I might say in about 8 to 6 months' time, there might be a slight underestimate. Inflation, according to these consensus forecasts, pretty stubbornly above the Bank of England's 2% target, hovering around 2.3%, 2.4%, but considerably better than the 5.2% which was hit earlier. Unemployment is a lagging indicator. Normally speaking, unemployment doesn't improve until the economy improves. So therefore, if you think the economy picks up towards the middle or the end of next year, unemployment won't significantly fall until after that. I'm being given time. Bank of England interest rates. This actually has some confidence in because there's something called interest rate swaps where people actually, they put their money where their mouth is. The other forecast I gave you, that's like a dime a dozen. Call them and they'll give you an estimate. But interest rate forecasts are actually based on actual, people actually, analysts putting a bit of money on it. And I think the Bank of England is very unlikely to move away from its record low of 0.5%. There are some who say, if the economy is still this weak, why not cut the rate further from 0.5%? And the reason is actually been explained by many people from the MPC, which is there's still lending and banks which rely on having a positive base rate, at least nominally. So they would find the damage is probably more to cut that rather than leave it there and use QE, for instance, as a stimulus instead. And that's why the consensus is probably 0.5% is the floor. And then very finally, this is where I am least confident. Greek bond yields. This is a quote for a 10-year bond yield. The few bonds which are actually trading barely in terms of the Greek sovereign debt. Just yesterday, 10-year yields fell below 15%, which is lower. This is the lowest since the debt was restructured for Greece. 11% probably prices in the fact there's a debt buyback at the moment, which is pricing the bonds slightly above the current yield, which is just about 15%. So the price of a bond moves inversely with its yield. So converting 11% yield into a price is basically saying that the debt buyback will be successful. There will be those who tender, put it in. The price, therefore, rises because these bonds start to have a little liquidity in trade and the yield comes down to 11%. There's a lot of this in there, and that I'm going to finish on that point. Everything that I've said has to be caveated by the known unknowns, and then there's the unknown unknowns. But the two big known unknowns is the debt buyback for Greece may not be successful. It may actually leave the Eurozone. Spain's bailout could bankrupt the Eurozone. Angela Merkel could lose her election next year. The Eurozone could begin to break apart. So aside from all of that, I think the yield will come down to 11%. And then there is also the issue of the U.S. fiscal cliff. They'll probably do a deal, but if they don't, there's a lot of ifs. China, we think those ghost cities and that bank lending looks okay. The government is in charge. Hey, but maybe with Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang, right before they take power in March, there's a big overthrow of them and huge instability from the Bo Xilai faction. So